all you cool cats and kittens. Hello.
Hey.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
To Killer Babes.
Podcast.
I'm Katie.
I'm Kirby.
This
is episode 39.
Yes.
Which is our second to last episode for season two.
Yes. Isn't there a name for, like, the one before the finale?
Penultimate.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is.
It's the next to last of anything.
Penultimate. Okay, so it's not just a TV show or something.
Yeah.
So it's our penultimate episode of season two.
Woohoo!
Yay! Everyone learned a new word.
Love learning new words. How's that going? Your word of the day.
Oh, I don't read those anymore. I read it for a week, can't remember anything, and now I haven't unsubscribed, so I just have to keep, like,
exiting
hitting
out.
Hitting read so that it doesn't show up on my, like, notifications.
That's funny.
Ugh, it's annoying. I think I picked a bad one. The words aren't good.
Yeah, I don't know.
So maybe I'll try a new one, but I mean, there's nothing else I'm doing during this time, so I probably should, but whatever. So this is going to be a long one because it's pretty in depth.
Yeah.
So we should probably just jump in, but I think we just should really quickly say, because on the last episode, we did ask people for TV recommendations.
Which no one gave us, but I watched my own TV. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. We figured it out on our own. Thanks. It's no news that Tiger King is, like, the number one thing right now on Netflix. So I'm sure everyone's already heard of it. But you guys should watch it. It's absolutely bonkers. I've already seen the whole thing, but Kirby's watching it now. So I'm not going to give anything away, but...
But... I mean, I've Googled some of it, so I kind of know the spoilers already, just because it's been in the news.
Don't tell them. What if they don't know?
No, this is not a spoiler.
Okay.
But Tiger King star Joe Exotic files $94 million lawsuit. He wants presidential pardon.
Dude, he's probably going to get it.
I don't know.
Just like anything goes these days.
Listen, Cardi B started a GoFundMe for him.
Cardi B started
one? Yeah. So, you know, this is, like, crazy.
Wait, why?
This is blowing up.
I don't think he... All right, well, I'm not going to state all my opinions, because if you guys haven't watched it, I don't think he should not be in jail. I'm not saying everyone that should be in jail is in jail, but...
But, okay, so one of the people, this isn't really giving it away, but one of the people in the docuseries, never wears a shirt, and it doesn't make sense, but there's an article solely dedicated from BuzzFeed to why he doesn't wear a shirt.
Oh.
Because everyone's asking the question. Literally, everybody. People are in their house just watching.
Do they give
this.
An answer? I feel like there is no answer. I feel like it's just...
Yeah, the answer's so silly. He wanted to show off all his tattoos.
Oh, so that was right. Yeah, that's what we thought.
Yeah, and that's it.
I mean, listen, tattoos are expensive, you know?
But, I mean, this is breaking news. Think about it. There's no sports going on. There's nothing else. So people are just zeroing in on this TV show.
I mean, everyone's saying, like, this literally couldn't have come at a, like, more perfect time. Like, these people lucked out.
I mean,
I'm sure this date has been planned for a while, so.
Oh, yeah.
They got lucky. And you know what? We got lucky, too. This is what we all needed.
It is, honestly. It really is. Because it starts off as just, like, a fun little docuseries.
Yeah, I was like, I'm gonna learn something about a tiger.
And then it's, like, murder, mayhem, mystery.
It's bonkers. So it'll get your mind off of things for sure.
Yeah.
Highly recommend.
So that's literally it in our updates.
Yeah. I think we should just jump in, give the people what they came here for.
I'm in.
Okay. So if you've never heard of this case before, settle in, y'all. I hope you're sitting back in a comfy chair. Because why would you not want to be? I don't know.
Or laying in bed.
Or yeah, that's true. Laying down. So this is our two-part season finale. This is part one, and next week will be part two, and it's a pretty detailed
one. That's how
one.
It goes with
yeah,
part one
this,
and two.
We've already been over that. So in part one, we're going to lay out the background of the case for you guys, and part two, we have a very special guest. We're going to be talking to Maureen Boyle, who's the author of Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. So we're going to get a lot more insight from her. Some really good
insight. Yeah.
Yeah. Some opinions and some answers on some theories and stuff. Mm-hmm. So definitely check that out after you listen to this one, guys. Okay. So here's a quick summary of the case that we're talking about this week. Over the spring and summer of 1988, 11 women went missing in New Bedford, Massachusetts. 9 women were found dead along the highways in the greater New Bedford area. The wave of bodies led the public to name the killer the New Bedford Highway Killer. 30 years later, families continue to mark special days without loved ones, while police follow up on leads in the unsolved murders of 9 women and the disappearance of 2 others. This string of murders is the worst serial killing case since the Boston Strangler. To date, there have been no convictions in any of the murders of the New Bedford woman. New Bedford, as we've talked about before in other episodes, was an old fishing port known as the Whaling City. The community is diverse with lots of rich history. New Bedford had a rise in economic wealth during the whaling times. Herman Melville himself shipped out aboard the whale ship Acushnet in 1841, which inspired him to write Moby Dick, all of our favorite books from school.
Yeah.
Remember that chapter about whiteness?
No.
That's all I remember from it. I feel like we've already talked about
it. I don't think I had to read the whole book. I just had to read like an excerpt. Yeah.
Lucky you. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. It's a classic.
Classic book. You should own it. Go out and buy it. Yeah. Read it.
Reading club. Then in 1846, New Bedford's first mill for the manufacture of cotton cloth opened. Around 1920, New Bedford became one of the largest producers of cotton yarns and textiles in the country, with 28 cotton establishments, operating 70 mills, and employing over 41,000 workers. The mills attracted immigrant populations from countries from all over, like Poland, French Canada, and Portugal, which would explain why there is such a large Portuguese population then and especially even now today. New Bedford was noted as one of the major stations of the Underground Railroad during the early to mid-19th century. The most famous fugitive to settle in New Bedford was Frederick Douglass, noted abolitionist speaker and leader. But with all these successes, New Bedford also suffered from a huge heroin dealing and abusing problem that has definitely continued to this day.
We're going to list the victims in order that they were found, and I strongly encourage you to read Maureen Boyle's book. And this isn't a plug, but she does the victims an amazing justice by really diving into their personal life, and she gets quotes from their family. We're just giving you a brief overview because, I mean, this would take literally, this could be its own podcast series. Yeah, this really could be its own podcast series. And I don't, is it? Has anyone done this as a full?
I don't think I didn't really actually look, but I don't think so.
I feel like they haven't. And someone out there, since you know, they're making docuseries.
Should definitely
do this because it really is extremely long when you dive into it.
I mean, yeah, if you're going to go into detail about every single victim and talk about their families and their personal life, I mean, that's just...
Yeah, it's quite detailed. So this is just a brief overview. The first victim, Deborah Medeiros, 30 years old, was last seen in New Bedford on May 27, 1988. She was said to have just ended her relationship with her first boyfriend. On the 4th of July weekend on July 3, 1988, a woman stopped to go to the bathroom about 30 feet from the road on northbound Route 140 in Freetown, Massachusetts. While she was doing her business, she spotted human skeletal remains with what looked like a bra wrapped around the neck. An autopsy of the badly decomposed female corpse showed the cause of death was strangulation and the body had been there for months. The discovery of Deborah Medeiros' body was the first of 9 bodies found along highways in the greater New Bedford area. Deborah Medeiros was found on July 3, 1988 on Route 140. The second victim, Nancy Paiva, 36 years old, was last seen in New Bedford July 7, 1988, walking in the South End. Nancy was a high school graduate who went to a secretarial school but later dropped out. She was married at 19 and had a daughter named Jill. She was later divorced and had a second daughter, Jolene. Nancy was also a grandmother with her daughter pregnant. Her family says she was a very supportive mother and grandmother. Paiva's family denies that she was ever involved in prostitution, and there were no arrest records for solicitation, but they said that she was in a very difficult domestic violence situation with a heroin dealer named Frankie. She had been to rehab for heroin in the past and NA meetings. It was a very hot day on July 30th, 1998, when Sister Judy DeSantos was headed back from the pool on Route 195. Her daughter Jolene Paiva said, quote, "I wish she could have seen her, but I try not to think about it. I look at it as if I have to stay strong for my daughter. I try to block it out of my mind," end quote. Her sister Jill thinks of her mother when she Her sister Jill thinks of her mother when her own two children, aged 10 and 11 at the time of this interview, gets angry when she refuses one of them any request. Quote, "When my kids say, 'You're mean,' I think of my mother and how we were in bed at 8 o'clock and we would see other kids playing outside. She would tell us that she didn't care what the other kids were doing. She always watched out for us," end quote. Detectives took the case seriously when her boyfriend, the dealer, reported her missing at the police station. Police knew him well, as he had had many run-ins in the past and had been to his place to deal with the domestic violence situation. According to some of those present, an argument between Nancy and Frankie ensued at Whispers Pub, a place known for cocaine and drugs. Frankie had ordered Nancy to leave the bar, Nancy left, and an acquaintance later said that she saw Nancy walking up the street towards her house around 7 p.m. with tears in her eyes. That was the last time anyone saw Nancy Paiva alive. Nancy Paiva was found July 30th, 1988, along Interstate 195 in Dartmouth, Mass., on the westbound side, in the woods. The third victim, Deborah DeMello, 35 years old, was last seen in New Bedford, July 11th, 1988. She had escaped from a prison work release program in Rhode Island on June 18th after charges for prostitution. Deborah came from a middle-class family but fell into drugs and an abusive relationship. She had a 15-year-old girl and two boys, 8 years old and 3 years old. Her remains were concealed by trees and her clothes were strewn in the nearby tree branches. What's strange is Nancy Paiva's clothes were found near Deborah DeMello's body. In an interview, her mother said, quote, "I think about my Deb and who did this terrible thing. I pray to God at night that we will put an end to this, but I'm not going to give up. But I'm getting older and I'd like to be able to find out who did this. My Deb is in heaven now. I can't bring myself to go near the cemetery at all. I drive by there and there are times I want to get away, like I'm running away," end quote. Deborah DeMello was found November 8, 1988, alongside Interstate 195 by a maintenance crew. It was nearby where Nancy Paiva had been found. Victim number four, Dawn Mendez, 25 years old, was last seen in New Bedford September 4, 1988, walking from her South End apartment to a family christening party. Mendez was one of 10 children in the Mendez family. She was also the mother of a 5-year-old boy. She had a history of prostitution and drug use. A year after her body was found, her mother described the last time she saw her daughter. Quote, "The last time I saw her, she was so thin. Drugs were controlling her. She was out there on drugs doing what she had to do, but she was a beautiful child. She was my child, and I will always love her," end quote. When asked about her daughter's boyfriend, she said, quote, "He had a spell on her. She was supporting two habits. If she did not go out there and make money to get drugs, she'd get beat. Just because somebody doesn't like their lifestyle doesn't mean they should take their life. If she could have changed her lifestyle, she would have. All of her torment is over. That's what keeps me going," end quote. Dawn Mendez was found November 29th, 1988, on the westbound Reed Road ramp off Interstate 195 by a search dog. Victim number five, Deborah Lynn McConnell, 25 years old, was last seen in New Bedford in May 1988 by a father in New Bedford who was at a cemetery after they had buried his wife and her mother. The family grew worried when she did not call her 10-year-old daughter on her birthday. Deborah Lynn McConnell was found on December 1st, 1988, off Route 140 in Freetown, Massachusetts, by a search dog. It wasn't until March 1989 that her remains were identified because of their terrible condition.
By this time, police dogs who were specifically trained to sniff out cadavers found Dawn Mendez and Deborah McConnell. There was no denying at this point that there was a serial killer on the loose. Victim number six, Rochelle Clifford Dopiarella, 28 years old, was last seen in New Bedford late April 1988. She was a mother of two. Rochelle had been a witness in the case against a man named Roger Swire who had raped her. He was being brought up by police on weapons charges. She was last seen with Nancy Paiva's boyfriend, an ex-convict who was cleared in both deaths. Rochelle was found on December 10, 1988, by hunters on ATVs in a gravel pit along Reed Road, about 2 miles from Interstate 195. This was the only person not found directly off of the highway. Victim number seven, Robin, aka Bobby Lynn Rhodes, 28 years old, was last seen in New Bedford, March or April of 1988, by her mother. She had a young child and was addicted to heroin and cocaine. While she was never involved in prostitution, she did hang out at the same saloons saloons. What is this, like, the Western? Same bars and in the same company as Rochelle, Dawn Mendez, and Nancy Paiva. She was good friends with Mary Rose Santos. Robin Rhodes was found on March 28, 1989, along Route 140 southbound in Freetown, Mass. By a search dog. Victim number 8, Mary Rose Santos, 26 years old, was last seen in New Bedford on July 16, 1988, dancing at the old quarterdeck lounge well into the morning. Her husband had dropped her off earlier near the downtown bus station, and witnesses said she planned to walk to a friend's apartment nearby, and that's when she went missing. A beer bottle was found among her remains. Santos was a mother of two. She was also a heroin addict. She was friends with Rochelle Dobriella and Nancy Paiva. Her son was 6 years old when she was murdered and spoke out 19 years later about her death. He said his parents had just reconciled after a brief separation and were planning to renew their vows. His mother had gone out looking for a wedding dress the day before she went missing. Mary Rose Santos was found on March 31st, 1989, along Route 88. Victim number 9, Sandra Botello, 24 years old, was last seen in New Bedford on August 11th, 1988, after leaving her apartment. She was a college dropout and engaged in prostitution and drug use. She had two sons, aged 4 and 6. Sandra Botello was found on April 12, 1989, along Interstate 195 in Marion, Mass. By a state highway crew. Now, the next two women, they were never actually found. Their bodies weren't found, but they are believed or may have been a part of the New Bedford highway serial killings. Victim number 10, Christine Montero, 19 years old, was last seen in New Bedford late May of 1988. Her mother was engaged to a Dartmouth police officer. Christine had a young child and was known to use heroin and cocaine. Christine Montero is still missing. Her body was never found. Victim number 11, Marilyn Roberts, 34 years old, was last seen in New Bedford in June of 1988. She was the daughter of a retired New Bedford police officer. She had a supportive family who tried to help her with her heroin addictions. Her family believed she had moved to the West Coast to live with a relative, but they later learned that she had not been in touch with any of her relatives. They reported her missing again in December of 1988 after they heard about a possible serial murderer in the area. She was neighbors with Montero. In 1998, her mother said, quote, "We're trying to get on with our lives. I just wish I had a grave to visit. I really don't know what happened to her, and it looks like I never will." Again, Marilyn Roberts' body was never found. She is still missing. There was definitely a terror running through New Bedford, Mass. Around this time. It's believed that a killer, or possibly even killers, took the lives of 11 women in all 6 months. Again, 9 of the women were found murdered. Their bodies were located, but 2 of them are still missing. Between all of the victims, they had 15 children in total. The victims all shared similarities. 11 women had vanished in the time span of 1988 to 1989 off of Interstate 195 and associated routes. I guess you'd call them, like, artilleries. I don't know. The bodies were in similar positions on their backs, their feet pointed toward the highway. There were also similarities between the victims, both brown-haired and just over 5 feet tall. Not only were they alike in appearance and age, but many were involved in drug use with heroin, domestic violence, and prostitution. The women were all found along the highways outside of New Bedford. They lived troubled lives. They were almost all mothers, except for one. Their deaths were pretty obviously planned and on purpose. The killer knew no one would come looking for them for a while. At least 6 of them knew each other. The killings were during a concentrated period, and specifically in one main radius. Some had clearly been strangled. Others were so badly decomposed that police were left to guess how they died. The New Bedford Highway Killer has yet to be brought to justice.
It's important to note that it was 1988 at the time, and DNA was brand new, thus rarely used. Using DNA to solve crimes was practically unheard of. Police reports were either handwritten or prepared on a manual typewriter, so they lacked certain details or were lost, which caused problems at the crime scene. Other problems included the collection of DNA, which was difficult. The remains were outdoors for months after being discovered, and by that time, they had been contaminated by animals, the element. It could have been washed away. The evidence wasn't there. The length of time the victims were out there complicated the investigation, and in some cases, clothing was on the bodies, while in others, it was found at or near the remains. If you're interested in learning more about the stages of decomposition, Maureen Boyle describes it very well in her book and then relates it back to the stages where the victims had been found at. The length of time the victims were out there complicated the investigation. In 1988, a swab was needed to gather DNA. Today, only a pinprick is sufficient. The likelihood of finding a suspect's DNA would be very, very small at this point, but it's not impossible. It still could happen. Besides lack of DNA, there was an accumulation of events and happenings that also made it pretty hard to find the killer. Knowledge of serial killers back then was severely limited. Known serial killers were rare, and detectives had no previous experience or cases to look to. It also took months and sometimes years or more to identify some of the victims. The media wasn't super invested like it would have been today. One, probably because they didn't have the media outlets that they have today and the way to spread media, but also because of the women's backgrounds. Luckily, in the area, detectives did care and they put a lot of time into the case. Massachusetts State Troopers Marianne Dill and Jose Gonzalez were two constants during this time. They knew the victims, the suspects, and the streets of New Bedford. They were there from the beginning of the case all the way to the end of the cold case, which is still going on. The witnesses that they did have all had drug problems, which made them an unreliable source. They had sketchy memories, and there was no concrete evidence linking one person to the killings. There were so many people being questioned at the time, because so many people wanted to close this case, that all the names eventually became public. This was also a very political time in history, and it was a pretty political case. As the largest criminal investigation in the region was underway, the DA at the time, Ronald Pina, was under a lot of pressure to solve the case. In 1990, he secured a grand jury indictment against Kenneth Pont, one of the suspects for the murder, which we will go into great detail on the suspects. But Pina publicly stated he thought Kenneth Pont was the highway killer. Pina lost re-election, and then Paul Wash Jr. was elected. Wash also publicly committed to solving the case, and on March 7, 1991, appointed Paul Buckley as special prosecutor. On July 29, 1991, the murder charge by the special prosecutor against Pont was dropped due to lack of evidence. The case went cold. Walsh and two of the original investigators believed Anthony DeGrazia, another suspect, was the highway killer. Nelson Ostaguy, who was briefly head of the state police investigative unit assigned to Mr. Walsh's office, and retired New Bedford detective Richard Fiera both believed DeGrazia was the highway killer. In 2006, Samuel Sutter was elected district attorney. He committed to solving cold cases within Bristol County. Many cases were solved, but the highway killings were not. Sutter was not convinced that DeGrazia was the killer and felt the evidence didn't point to that person. And in 2014, Sutter resigned and was elected mayor of the city of Fall River. Thomas Quinn was appointed district attorney in 2015 and was reelected, holding office today.
One thing that made this case unique was that there was no shortage of suspects. In fact, it could be argued that the police had too many leads to sift through. From people thinking their ex-boyfriends were suspicious to psychics calling, claiming they've had visions of the murders. And it was hard to narrow the pool of suspects down. Many had the motive and the opportunity, but no one was convicted. Mostly because they just really did not have any hard evidence to connect anyone to the crimes. But there were some prominent suspects that stuck out, even to this day. One was an accused prostitute rapist who later committed suicide. Another was an attorney who had connections to several of the deceased victims. But to date, there has been no conviction in any of the murders of the New Bedford woman. We really want to emphasize that. No one has ever been found guilty of these murders. So, in this great country, that means that they are innocent. So we are going to present and tell you guys a little bit about the most prominent suspects, but we just think it's kind of important that everyone understands that at this point it's really just speculation. We don't have any evidence, so we're not the police. Whether the following people are dead or still alive, we don't really think that their names should be slandered without any evidence. But that being said, we're still gonna tell you guys just about why these names have been brought up, basically.
The top ones, yeah.
Yeah, the top ones. And we do know that they have been questioned by police for their involvement. So the first suspect is Kenneth Pont, who we have already mentioned. Ken Pont was a New Bedford attorney and deputy sheriff. He was a supposed reformed heroin addict who cleaned up his act, went to law school, and made a living with lower-level civil and criminal cases. Most believe that Pont was designated deputy sheriff because he donated to the Bristol County Sheriff's election campaign. He was also pretty well known around town as a heavy cocaine abuser, especially by the girls on the street who he'd pick up, bring back to his place, lock all the doors, and do drugs with. The girls did claim that he was definitely strange, full of paranoia, but that he never tried anything sexual with them. Pont moved to Florida in September 1988, entered a plea of, quote, absolutely not guilty, and posted a $50,000 bond. In August 1990, a grand jury indicted Ken on the murder of Rochelle Dopierella, who had been beaten to death. Pont had a prior incident involving Rochelle. Pont admitted to having represented Rochelle in April 1988 on a rape case, shortly before she disappeared. In March of 1991, the district attorney dropped murder charges against Pont because they just did not have enough evidence to convict him. The following year, the drug and assault charges were also dropped. Gonzalez, the lead investigator, noted, quote, "Unfortunately, he chose not to speak to us about his relationship with the homicide victims. It forced us to spend a lot of time and efforts following up on various leads and bits of information. Ultimately, his cooperation could have saved us a lot of effort and benefited him in the long run," end quote. And this wasn't the end of Pont's track history. In 1997, Pont was disbarred for using $12,000 of a client's insurance settlement for personal use. In 2004, he was charged with animal cruelty for neglecting his cat. Then Pont resurfaced in the news in May of 2009 in two separate incidents. Police ended up digging up the driveway and patio of Pont's former home, but they found nothing. On the morning of May 15th, Pont was arrested for shoplifting and was found with four cans of sardines and a block of cheese stolen from a Price Right store in New Bedford. And I just feel like we have to include those items because who the fuck gets sardines? And then in January of 2010, Kenneth Pont, at 60 years old, was found bloated and dead on top of two stacked mattresses at his home in New Bedford, Mass. It was a suspected overdose, and the Bristol County District Attorney's Office discounted foul play as a cause of death. All right, next suspect is Anthony DeGrazia, who we've also mentioned. In May of 1989, Anthony DeGrazia was identified via a photograph by a locally known New Bedford prostitute who had claimed he looked like the man who had assaulted her. DeGrazia was later accused of 17 rapes and assaults on several prostitutes, for which he was charged, while also being investigated as a suspect in the New Bedford highway killings. DeGrazia was interviewed by the grand jury, but was never charged. After 15 months of incarceration and 18 court appearances, DeGrazia was released on bail in January 1990. He was then briefly rearrested for allegedly threatening DA Ronald Pina for wrongful prosecution, after which he again posted bond. But DeGrazia was later found dead at his girlfriend's house under a picnic table. It was ruled a suicide. Anthony DeGrazia was a loner, many would say a person who appeared to fit the classic serial killer profile. Childhood filled with abuse, yet a charming, charismatic personality, a story as old as time. He was also prone to bursts of violence. He served at a Catholic church during the day and then roamed the streets of New Bedford at night looking for a girl. The main consensus within the world of internet sleuths, if you will, is that out of the known suspects, Pont or DeGrazia most closely fits the bill. But there were other prominent suspects in the case, so we'll go through some of them now, but we're not going to name these ones out by name just because they're a little bit less known. But if you are interested, you can figure it out. You can Google it. So one man was in prison for murdering his mother. While he was in prison, he sent a threatening letter to one of the prison staff indirectly claiming responsibility for the highway killings. He did live in New Bedford and apparently had knowledge of where another murdered woman, Gail, had been buried, just within a mile from his home. He has been convicted of two recent killings of Brian and Bev Mock. In 2015, he was convicted of the murder of Gail Botello, who went missing in 1988.
Between 1992 and 1993, across the big pond or ocean in Lisbon, Portugal, three prostitutes were slain and disemboweled by an unknown serial killer that was dubbed the Lisbon Ripper. At the same time, two prostitutes were shot dead on the opposite shore of the Tagus River. In March 1993, two detectives of the Portuguese Policiala Judiciaria traveled to New Bedford to gather information on the highway killings. While two agents of the FBI traveled to Lisbon, following a theory that the string of crimes on both sides of the Atlantic could have been committed by the same person. Now, if you're familiar with the area, the Greater New Bedford area, you are aware that there's a sizable Portuguese community. And if you aren't aware, you are now.
I just saw this map the other day that it's really funny. You should Google it. It's like a map of Massachusetts, and it portions out a bunch of parts of the state, and it just says like whatever stereotype there is for that region. Is pretty funny and also spot on. And like the entire southeast portion of Mass just says West Portugal. And it's true. And the part you're from just says like cranberry box.
Oh, this isn't. Yeah. Okay. Beaches with killer flies. That's super accurate. Witches, fishermen, and quaint ass towns.
The entire like central Mass just says like there be dragons.
Yeah. And then the other part is snow and long commutes. Oh yeah, in Worcester. Oh. Yeah. Hippie students. That's where Amherst is. Accurate. Okay. Hippie farmers. Basketball. Yeah. I mean, it's
spot on. So like, if you're not from here and you just want a
generalization. Now this is kind of crazy. In 2011, a 21-year-old man applied to participate in a Portuguese edition of the reality TV show Secret Story, where participants try to guess each other's secrets while concealing their own. What can't go wrong on a TV show like this? Like, why would you even apply to this? It's crazy.
It's a good show, though. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't. Is it?
It's old.
Is it like?
Well, maybe not. That's 2011.
In English, though, because it's a Portuguese show?
Well, I don't know. I've seen the English version. I'm sure the Portuguese one is in Spanish, but...
Oh, I see. There's like two different versions.
Sorry. Oh, my God.
In Portuguese. Okay, so this man applied with the secret that his father was the Lisbon Ripper. His father was arrested and confessed to the three slayings, but could not be prosecuted because the murder had a prescription period of 15 years in Portugal. And the last murders had ended in 2008. He could be prosecuted for the 2000 murder of a prostitute in Portugal and similar murders in Germany, which is in the neighboring vicinity, if you look at it, where he resided in 1990. But it's still unknown if he ever resided in the U.S. Suspect number 5 was identified as being involved with assaulting and raping prostitutes from the Weld Square area of New Bedford during the highway killings. He was charged with rape and attempt to rape, and was indicted in an additional rape that took place in the reservation in Fall River. He was interviewed by a grand jury, but never convicted until 1994, when he was convicted of aggravated rape. But the court released him on September 20th, 2006, and on August 16th, 2007, he was accused of robbing the Northeastern Savings Bank in Easton. On September 6th, 2007, he's accused of robbing the Slay Bank in Swansea. He is also the suspect in a couple of robberies in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. The sixth suspect, it could really actually be anyone because it's pretty broad, but given the seasonality of the disappearances, some people speculated that the killer could be a transient who worked on a fishing vessel based in New Bedford, because we mentioned that New Bedford is the largest fishing port and it's pretty busy. This is something that the police definitely looked into. The killings may have been committed by somebody who was in the commercial fishing fleet that visited New Bedford and then returned to another state and then went back and forth. But, I mean, it was too broad of a generalization for them to pin anyone down as a suspect. So this is crazy, too. The suspect number 7 was a writer of an unknown letter. Bristol County District Attorney Ronald Pina said his office received an anonymous letter 2 weeks before the second woman, Nancy Paiva, was found that said that the person witnessed one of the killings. This anonymous writer claimed that if a body turned up on Route 88 in Westport, the writer would come forward and tell them who the killer was. Lo and behold, a body turned up on Route 88, but no one came forward. Ronald Pina was quoted as saying, quote, "The person who sent the letter said they had information and had seen what they believed to be a person who may have been doing these killings. I don't know if this is accurate, but what they did say is if we found a body on Route 88, then that would confirm their story," end quote. Pina said the letter was explicit in that we never had a body on Route 88 before in these cases. It sounded very good, but it didn't fit. Now it fits, and the person said if it fit, they would come forward. So what happened? People have looked into this letter and never found anything. Pina never brought up the letter, and it never really went out to anybody in the public. We interviewed, in our next section, Maureen Boyle, who gave her opinion on what exactly happened with that letter. It's pretty interesting, so stay tuned on her theory about that. Suspect number 8 is actually two people. They lived an hour away, they're brothers, from the radius of the dump site. One was convicted of rape, but he had been accused of a string of extremely violent and sadistic rapes and attempted rapes over the years. He served a life sentence in Georgia. The other brother was convicted of a murder of a prostitute in 2012, but court records showed that he had a history of violence against women that stretched for over a decade. This brother was acquitted on charges of rape and murder in 2007 in West Boylston. However, after the acquittal in the same courtroom, he was formally charged with the rape and murder of another woman in Fitchburg.
And the 9th and final suspect is actually a multitude of suspects. These are other serial killers that they're known serial killers who were alive and active around the same time frame that the New Bedford killings happened, 1988 to 1989. We won't go into too much depth on each one because you can just Google them. And we will say their names because obviously they have either been convicted of these murders and sentenced to death, or one of the killers is an unknown killer, so I can't even say a name. But anyway, here's the short and sweet on other serial killers that were active during the same time frame. So we got William Suff. William tortured, strangled, raped, mutilated, and murdered 12 victims over 7 years in Riverside, California between 1989 and 1. The victims were prostitutes. He was sentenced to death at San Quentin State Prison in San Quentin, California. So, obviously, he was in California. Probably not him, but he was active around the same time. Also, Lonnie David Franklin, a.k.a. the Grim Sleeper, murdered 10 victims over 23 years between 1985 and 2008. But allegedly, the span includes about a 14-year hiatus between 1988 and 2002. Franklin shot, raped, and strangled his victims, who were not all, they were mostly, but they weren't all women, around South Los Angeles, California. Franklin was also sentenced to death at the San Quentin State Prison in San Quentin, California. So again, he was in California, probably not responsible for these, but who knows. Lastly, we have the Connecticut River Valley Killer, a.k.a. Killer Babes, episode 17.
Promo.
Just had to sneak that in there. So this was it's a still unknown serial killer. There's no one convicted of these killings. And they are believed to be responsible for multiple stabbing murders around Claremont, New Hampshire, and the Connecticut River Valley region, primarily occurring in the 1980s. So go listen to episode 17 for a full recap. The last presumed victim of these killings was nurse Barbara Agnew, who was returning from a ski outing on January 10, 1987. That evening, her car was found at a rest stop in Hartford, Vermont. On March 28, 1987, Agnew's body was found stabbed to death in Heartland, Vermont. The killings had apparently stopped when, late in the evening on August 6, 1988, 22-year-old Jane Borowski was approached by a man who asked her if the payphone was still working, at which time he grabbed her and pulled her from her vehicle. They struggled, and the man stabbed her 27 times before driving away and leaving her to die, but she managed to get help, and she lived to tell the tale. So after the incident with Jane, the killings ceased following that attack, and the case became cold. They never found the killer. Now, the MO with the New Bedford killer and the Connecticut River Valley killer is different. The New Bedford highway killer didn't stab their victims, while all of the Connecticut Valley victims were all but certainly stabbed to death. But the timeline does fit. Barbara Agnew was killed in 1987, and Deborah Medeiros, who was the first found victim of the New Bedford killings, she was last seen in 1988, so a year apart. And while New Bedford is not quite Vermont's backyard, it's not crazy to think that the killer could have traveled to the next state south in the slight gap between the killings. Now let's take a look at what we know of serial killers now. The organized slash disorganized classification of offenders is the centerpiece of the FBI profiling approach. According to Psychology Today, quote, a serial murder case can also be a mix of organized and disorganized. This occasionally occurs when there are multiple offenders of different personality types involved in the killings. It can also occur when a lone offender is undergoing a psychological transformation throughout his or her killing career.
Mm-hmm.
Sexist. So that is interesting. It could mean that maybe the Connecticut River Valley killer started off young, naive, assaulted and stabbed their victims. And it kind of says that a serial killer can also alter and refine their MO, right? So they can change their modus operandi to accommodate new circumstances or to incorporate new skills and information. For example, instead of using rope to tie up a victim, the offender may learn that it's easier and more effective to bring handcuffs to the crime scene. But for more insight onto the theory that perhaps the Connecticut River Valley killer may have also been the New Bedford Highway killer, check out next week's episode with Maureen. We do ask her that, and she does have an answer for us. She has her own theories, so we're going to delve into that a little more. And also just why the police could not rule out anything or anyone at that time, which is why there were so many suspects.
Yeah. It was kind of rare because usually you don't have any suspects, but in this one, there were way too many.
Right. Like we've seen cases from both sides, and it's almost like they both have
that medium.
Yeah. It's obviously you want to have more suspects than none,
mm-hmm.
but it can get overwhelming if you have too many. So right. That seems like might have.
This is what happened here. Yeah.
Yeah.
The killer may have even been a Jack the Ripper fan. The Jack the Ripper murders occurred in 1888 in the East End of London and was only a threat to a very small section of the community. The person attacked prostitutes at night on the street with a knife. I think in an ideal, perfect world, the two serial killings would be solved. Unfortunately, they aren't. If the killings had happened today, they definitely would have been solved because it's just a different era of evidence, DNA, testing. There's just a lot more technology that can help solve it. This is actually an interesting topic that we discuss with Maureen on how would this case have been different if it had happened today. From exponential advances into fingerprinting and DNA testing to security cameras to social media, there's not a doubt in our minds that we would have known who the killer was for both of those, for any of them, for a lot of these killings that happened.
For most, then. Yeah, for most old cold cases. Well, this one specifically, but I think a lot of cases you could say that about.
Right. So it's stretching it to say Jack the Ripper could have been responsible, but it's not stretching it to say a fan wouldn't have been responsible, someone who knew about the killings and brought it back to New Bedford, Mass. But with no evidence in any of these cases, it'd be irresponsible to not explore every possible avenue. It would be someone familiar with police work, a trucker passing through the area, a fisherman, an attorney, an ex-cop, someone who had never even crossed the law with enforcement. There's so many people it could have been. So the question really is, who is the killer?
Yeah. So that's the story. You pose a very difficult question when you ask who did it. Who do you think did it?
Who did it?
Is it solvable at all at this point? Who knows? That's one of the things we talk about with Maureen. How she thinks that this case is going to get solved at this point, which I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of interesting stuff that she has to add to the story and ideas that she had that we hadn't thought about before. So, guys, stay tuned for next week. There's a lot more coming. Maureen was amazing. The interview is really interesting.
Yeah, stay tuned.
And listen
to next week, because it'll be out next week. And stick with us as we have one episode left for season 2.
That's right. Episode 40, we'll wrap it up for the season. Not for the year. We'll come back later this year, but that's it for season 2 after next week. So stay tuned, and I hope everyone's keeping safe out there.
And sanitizing and washing your hands.
Yep. Wash your hands. Okay, bye.
Bye.